got the problem is Biden. Because you look at what Biden did. Biden did what they would like to have me do, except for one problem. I didn't do it. What Biden did is a disgrace. What his son did is a disgrace. The son took money from Ukraine. The son took money from China. A lot of money from China. China would love to see, they could think of nothing they'd rather see than Biden get in, because they will take this great deal that we're about to make, and they would really have themselves a deal for themselves. So let me just tell you, what Biden did was wrong.
President Trump arriving at the United Nations this morning, dismissing allegations he asked Ukraine's president to dig up dirt on Joe Biden. The former vice president hit back on the campaign trail over the weekend. Here he is at the Iowa Steak Fry, lambasting a reporter who asked him about his son Hunter Biden's overseas business dealings.
Trump's doing this because he knows I'll beat him like a drum. And he's using the abuse of power and every element of the presidency to try to do something to smear me. Everybody looked at this, and everybody's looked at it, said there's nothing there. Ask the right question.
Mr. Biden, okay.
Well, it's the latest back and forth in the big whistleblower story that's been developing minute by minute recently. To help us make sense of all of this, we turn now to Ben Schrechinger, national political correspondent for Politico. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about what President Trump is talking about. He called Joe Biden a disgrace and what Hunter Biden did as a disgrace. What exactly is he accusing both of them of?
He appears to be accusing them of corruption, bribery, some sort of quid pro quo. He's at times vague about exactly what the allegation is.
Okay, but let's go back and get the facts, because Hunter Biden was on the board of a Ukrainian national gas company. Can you tell us about that?
So back in April of 2014, Hunter, as well as a business partner and friend of his named Devin Archer, take seats on the board of Burisma Holdings, which is a Ukrainian natural gas company whose founder at the time had been facing investigative scrutiny for a couple of years, potential money laundering, tax evasion. So as part of an effort to make inroads in the West, show that he's making an effort at due diligence, he puts these Americans on the board, including Hunter Biden, whose father at the time was overseeing Ukraine policy for the Trump administration. Hunter didn't have experience in the energy sector. He didn't have experience doing business in Ukraine. So the appointment at the time raised some eyebrows, given the fact that his father was overseeing Ukraine policy. Mm. Fast forward to 2 years later, the prosecutor general, who has oversight of some of the investigations into Burisma and its founder, Viktor Shokin, is pushed out by the Ukrainian government, basically at the behest of Joe Biden, who is acting on behalf of the Obama administration, saying, "We want Shokin out." The administration considered Shokin corrupt. Other Western institutions didn't like him, considered him corrupt. The problem is that Shokin's office at the time did have these investigations. It doesn't sound like they were aggressively pursuing them at the time. But ethics experts have weighed in and said that this, has the appearance of a potential conflict of interest.
Right. So that's what President Trump is trying to raise here, saying basically that this guy, that Obama pressured this prosecutor pressured the government to get rid of this prosecutor because he was looking into a company that Hunter Biden was involved with.
And to be clear, there's no indication that the Obama administration's calculus was affected by this relationship with Hunter Biden. There had been Obama administration officials who, in fact, had been, vocally supportive of these investigations into Burisma, into its founder. But the sort of coincidence of circumstances where Joe Biden is the one delivering this message, telling the Ukrainian government that the U.S. is going to withhold loan guarantees if they don't get rid of Shokin, has raised eyebrows and has led ethics experts to say that this has at least the appearance of a potential conflict of interest.
Mm. But why was Hunter Biden interested in being on the board of this Ukrainian company to begin with?
Well, his compensation reportedly in some months was as high as $50,000 a month. So I suppose almost anyone would jump at the chance for a well-paid seat on the board of an energy company.
Right. Even though he didn't speak the language, he had no experience in energy, any of that.
Right. And he had been seeking deals, investment opportunities around the country and around the world at that point as part of this Rosemont Seneca venture, which he had been pursuing along with Chris Hines, who is John Kerry's stepson.
And Rosemont Seneca is a private equity firm, and Hunter Biden's a partner there. And this is also where President Trump is bringing in China, because Rosemont Seneca invested in some Chinese entities backed by the Bank of China.
So Hunter and Devin ended up doing business in China. Chris Hines has said that he had nothing to do with either the Burisma board positions or the dealings in China, despite the use of Rosemont names and Rosemont entities, because the Rosemont name is associated with the Hines family. He's disavowed this, but Hunter and Devin Archer formed a partnership with a firm called Bohai Harvest, a Chinese investment firm, and formed a vehicle called Bohai Harvest RST, which did a number of investments in China, including some that have financing from state-backed firms or, in at least one case, probably several invest in technologies that are used by the Chinese state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so none of this is illegal, right? And so why all the clouding accusations on the part of President Trump? Is this basically him trying to just throw up a bunch of stuff to make it look like something nefarious was going on?
While Trump is often a very successful political opportunist, there are real legitimate questions about the propriety of some of these dealings and the question of whether there were sufficient firewalls between Hunter and his father. And ethics experts have said that Biden's relatives, that any president's relative should forego seeking foreign sources of financing while Biden would be in the Oval Office. So Trump has seized on this as a potential opportunity to fling mud, potentially dig up dirt. He has been overstating the case in terms of whether there's actually been clear evidence of wrongdoing that's emerged. There hasn't. And he apparently is pressuring the government of Ukraine to try to reopen investigations and see if he can fling dirt at Biden heading mm-hmm. into this presidential
yeah.
contest.
But this is difficult for Biden because Biden, you know, I guess the more this is brought up, the more there are questions raised about what you've described as the propriety of these dealings. But then he has to fight back if he's in campaign mode.
That's right. Ironically, this move, which looks sort of boneheaded and brazen by Trump, could end up inflicting some damage on Biden, simply because to understand what Trump allegedly is doing here, you do have to understand the backstory of Hunter's business dealings. And Joe Biden is in a competitive primary right now. Someone like Elizabeth Warren, who appears to be his next closest challenger for the nomination, has run on a good governance platform. So this is something that is difficult for Joe Biden to capitalize on, despite what seems to be clear missteps by the president here.
All right, Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Schreckinger with Politico. Let's look now at the legal questions surrounding Trump and this call where he apparently asked Ukrainian officials to investigate the Bidens. Jessica Levinson is here, as she is most Mondays. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal. Hello there.
Hello there. Here every Monday that's not a government holiday.
Well, it's good to see you. Why is asking a foreign government to investigate your political rival problematic from a legal standpoint?
Let's put to the side the potential ethical and moral and political considerations and say that what are we looking at here? We're looking at potential issues of violations of the federal bribery statute, the federal extortion statute, the federal campaign finance laws, and the Federal Corrupt Practices Act. Now, I don't think this is a kind of slam dunk case of absolutely this is bribery, because for anyone who's reading former prosecutors, current lawyers who practice in this area talk about it, there's differing opinions. But does it raise serious questions of bribery, extortion, election law, corrupt practices? Absolutely.
However, heads of state frequently use military aid, if indeed that was the promise there, the delivering of military aid in exchange for this investigation, which has not been proven yet. Presidents frequently use military aid as a wedge, a way to get countries to do what they want them to do.
Yeah. So for all of the actions that we're talking about, there's essentially two things that have to happen. There's the president exerting some sort of force or persuasion, and that happens all the time. Presidents constantly try and convince Congress, try and convince foreign heads of state, do what I want, and here's the carrot that I'm going to give you to get you to do what I want. What's different in this case is that what President Trump wants in return isn't, and do what I want because it's good for the global economy, or do what I want because it's better for the national, for the security of that area or the stability of that area. He's saying, do what I want because I want something that's going to help my election campaign. And that's what makes this fundamentally different. So we talked about when it comes to, we've talked about this in the past when it came to digging up dirt, for instance, on Hillary Clinton and the famous Trump Tower meeting, whether or not opposition research is a thing of value. Here we are again talking about one of the big legal questions is the president saying to the Ukrainians, if he in fact did, basically start this investigation because it's going to be helpful for me in my political campaign, is that a thing of value? I think the better answer is yes, we could absolutely embrace a definition of a thing of value that includes that.
Mm, interesting. And then there's also the issue of asking a foreign government for help in a U.S. election.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what the federal campaign finance violation would boil down to, which is you cannot have a foreign national, including the head of state, for instance, provide money to try and affect an election. And in this case, it could be money, again, or a thing of value. If the opposition research is a thing of value, it's a foreign national trying to interfere with our elections. Now, there's also broader questions here of corrupting the whole process. I mean, all of these statutes that we're talking about, dealing with bribery, dealing with extortion, dealing with campaign finance, dealing with corrupt practices, they still all, in a way, don't envision, Congress didn't in a way even understand that a president might be in this position. And so again, we're seeing President Trump's alleged actions kind of acting as a stress test on our legal system. And now we're trying to figure out, like, which bucket does this fit within?
Yeah. Well, so I guess, what if the investigation turns out that Hunter Biden didn't do anything wrong, or if there is an investigation launched, or Joe Biden didn't do anything wrong, then would that thing of value not be a thing of value? You know what I mean? Because it wouldn't count against him, politically.
So we had such a similar question when it came to the Trump Tower meeting and like opposition research on Hillary Clinton. And what if it actually wasn't dirt at all? And what the campaign finance statute, at least, and the other statutes we're talking about embrace is the idea that an attempt could be enough. So even trying to get a thing of value might be enough in some of these instances. And so just following through and having the conversation, trying to get them to do something that's helpful for your political campaign alone could be problematic, even if nothing comes of it.
What about the issue of the inspector general not turning over the whistleblower's complaint to Congress? That is a violation of law. Is that a clear-cut case? And what if he was pressured by President Trump?
Yeah. Is that a clear-cut case? I mean, I'm always a little anxious about saying slam dunk case. I would say it looks like that is, yes, it looks like that's a problem. It looks like that should have been turned over. That's frankly why we know about this at all, because Representative Adam Schiff sent a letter saying, you need to turn this over. Under the law, I have to be able to see it. There's a lot of questions here about the inspector general, the Department of Justice in general. How much political pressure is it under, not just in this specific action, but we could talk about a lot of actions where it looks like the Department of Justice is not as independent as maybe the framers envisioned, for instance.
So there's a lot of talk of ramping up the impeachment inquiry, and we have talked about a sitting president not being able to be indicted. Is that where this would head if there were any repercussions?
So, yes, it's interesting because, again, this idea from there's a Department of Justice memo that's not just from this Department of Justice. It dates back decades that says you can't indict a sitting president in part because of separation of powers concerns. And the idea is because we have a mechanism to deal with presidents who behave badly. It's called impeachment. And so it puts more pressure on this idea that we do, in fact, need to use impeachment proceedings. The idea that there's no other way, at least while the president is still president, to punish him. And so what does that mean for impeachment? That's a political question. I think that there's a difference at this point between activists who are getting incredibly antsy, that's probably an understatement, and the Democratic electorate that might not be there. Again, remember, impeachment by the House is a simple majority. Conviction by the Senate, which is what actually removes a president, is a two-thirds vote. I think we're in a situation now where we have separation of parties, not separation of powers. I don't see a conviction.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School. She is our regular Monday Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we are almost at the end of the end drive. Just a few seconds here to get you, if you haven't done so already, I know a lot of us, I am guilty of this myself, of procrastinating to the very, very last minute. Well, now is the last minute because tomorrow it's over. So we have an ambitious two-day challenge to help us cross the finish line. If we can raise $35,000 by midnight tomorrow, your pledge will be matched dollar for dollar, courtesy of our board member, Sari Kane. So that's a pretty good incentive right there. KCRW.com/join and do it now. Do not put it off a second longer. And thank you. Coming up, the fight between the U.S. and Iran escalates. Are we getting closer to war? That conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, this week at the UN General Assembly, two countries are not expected to meet, and that would be the United States and Iran. Iran's foreign minister said yesterday he would not be sitting down with his American counterpart. This comes after an attack on Saudi oil fields, which the U.S. says was the work of Iran. The U.S. recently imposed tougher sanctions on Iran that Iran's leader says were desperation. Just weeks ago, there was hope the U.S. and Iran would meet, with the urging of other world leaders hoping a meeting would cool tensions between the two countries. Well, joining us to talk about all this is Robin Wright. She's a fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington and a columnist for The New Yorker. Hi.
Great to be with you.
Well, there were plans for the United States and Iran to meet, at least informally this week. What changed?
The attack on Saudi Arabia clearly was a game changer. A month ago, as you pointed out, there was a lot of momentum, a hope that the French could broker some kind of new arrangement, a broader deal than the 2015 nuclear accord between Iran and the United States. There had been a meeting during the G7 summit in Biarritz. President Trump was there. The Iranian foreign minister flew in to talk about some of the details. But the attack on Saudi Arabia has made that now much harder. The door is still ajar, but there is very little light coming through the door. Don't rule out diplomacy, but there are a lot of things now under consideration in terms of how you respond to these attacks, if Iran is indeed proven to be involved, and how do you move forward to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
Right. Is there any question that Iran wasn't behind the attacks?
The Houthi rebels in Yemen originally claimed it. Of course, they are supported by Iran and armed by Iran. So there is a great likelihood that Iran was involved in some way, either directly or indirectly. But this was a very sophisticated attack. And there are a lot of unknowns still. The U.S. has made allegations. The British have signed on to that conclusion that Iran was responsible. But we still need to see the list, to find out whether it was direct or indirect, because it tells us two different things. For 40 years, since the 1979 revolution, Iran has engaged in what were plausible deniability attacks through proxies, the attacks on the American embassies in Lebanon and the Marine peacekeepers in Lebanon. When I lived there in the early 1980s, those were carried out by Iran's proxies, allies within Lebanon. Similar attacks have taken place, whether it's by militias in Iraq against U.S. forces, militias in Afghanistan by local militias, that in many places these attacks have happened, but Iran can say, you know, our fingerprints aren't directly on it, you can't find them. This, if Iran is proven to be responsible for the attacks on Saudi oil installation, would be a dramatic change in their strategic calculations, in their tactics, and would put us all on a much more dangerous course.
And the United States on Friday moved military equipment to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And so that really raised the specter that this could become a military conflict. Although there haven't been any military strikes yet, how much does that up the ante as well?
The U.S. focus at the moment is to deploy some defensive equipment, not in huge numbers in terms of personnel, in the Gulf to back up the equipment that's being put there. The focus, primary focus right now, is organizing an international maritime coalition that will deploy in the Gulf in order to provide security for the tanker traffic that 20% of the world's shipping oil shipped to the outside world comes through the Strait of Hormuz that is between Iran and the Gulf states. And this is both to provide protection, security for the tanker traffic, but also to signal to Iran, we're here, don't engage in any mischief or you may pay a price. The United States is not at the point yet, I think, until we get more evidence, until there's more of an international consensus, that it wants to take kinetic action. But that doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia doesn't take kinetic action, doesn't respond, retaliate militarily. After all, Saudi Arabia was the country attacked. And the danger for the United States, as we've seen so often in the past, is once we get involved, it's hard to walk back over the threshold and not engage. We then become targets for attacks as well. And so I think there's a lot of discussion going on about what precise role. And after all, there are other things we can do that are not even visible, like cyber. There's an organization called NetBlocks, which reported that on Friday there was a cyber attack on Iran.
What about the sanctions the administration announced? They do seem very tough. And obviously, we saw the foreign minister react to them, saying they were economic terrorism. What is that going to do to Iran?
Iran was already facing punitive sanctions that are unprecedented. And this adds to the layers. It's one of the reasons that Iran wants to actually to go back to the negotiating table, because they believe at this point that it's in their interest to do a deal with President Trump that would involve him going to Congress to permanently lift sanctions so that the next American president wouldn't reverse course and do something tougher or different. That they want any kind of deal, something that's bigger, to be part of law so that there is a security that there won't be sanctions, that if sanctions are lifted, they are lifted permanently. But Iran, a year ago, had, as the U.S. was considering new sanctions, it was really hit hard. The currency value plummeted by 70%. And that was before sanctions were reimposed. There is a huge psychological factor in all of this. Iran has since then been able to cope with the fluctuations, has the currency values actually improved somewhat. What they want to make sure is that they can continue to somehow to sell oil so there won't be these huge gyrations. But sanctions has made sure that they won't sell very much oil. And so they'll continue to pay a price. It's just how much of a price.
So President Rouhani will be in New York on Wednesday. And do you expect any of these talks to be jump-started with his appearance? Is it, or will the stalemate and war of words continue?
Both President Trump and President Rouhani have ruled out a meeting in New York during the UN General Assembly. It's very hard to rule out absolutely anything anytime they are all in the same hall, at least some of the time. But it now looks like it's very unlikely. Again, the door is a little bit ajar for diplomacy down the road. It doesn't happen to have to happen at the UN. But the fact is, both sides have still indicated they're willing to consider, under conditions in the case of Iran, sanctions have to be some of them waived or have a formula to eventually lift them all. And of course, President Trump wants to make sure that Iran is willing to talk broader than the last nuclear deal. President Rouhani is scheduled to give his speech on Wednesday, and he's going to, according to Iranian sources I've talked to over the weekend, including the foreign minister, he is going to talk about trying to create a new Gulf coalition on security that would include all those states that share that land, that share borders with that important waterway. The Gulf states are very unlikely to be interested in that kind of arrangement. The hostilities now are very deep. They go back centuries, even millennia, between Arabs and Persians and the sheikdoms today and a revolutionary theocracy in Iran. But I think everybody's trying to figure out a way to de-escalate this to make sure we don't get into yet another Middle East war.
Robin Wright, fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington and a columnist for The New Yorker. Robin, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, now is crunch time for us here at KCRW. You know, we're in the final day or two of our UNDRIVE. Tomorrow we end it, and we just come to you twice a year to ask you for your support because we really can't be on the air bringing you the news, the conversations, the stuff that makes you understand that what's going on in this topsy-turvy world. It's really complicated out there, and what we try to do is bring you some kind of cohesion and some kind of connection, too, because that's really important. To connect you to the world, connect you to everyone else out there, and we just need you to connect with us. KCRW.com/join. Coming up on the program, the United Nations is talking about climate change this week.
What we really need to do is focus on the fact we're having warming that's causing extreme weather, fires and floods, and that we can do something about that by focusing on carbon drawdown right now.
We answer your questions about climate change next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
You have stolen my dreams, my childhood, with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Greta Thunberg, at the opening of the United Nations Climate Summit this morning. The goal of the summit, to, quote, kickstart a global campaign against climate change. Well, this week we're continuing our worldwide collaboration among hundreds of news outlets called Covering Climate Now. And as part of that coverage, we asked for your questions about climate change. and we got them. Aradhana Tripathi joins me now to answer those questions. She is UCLA professor at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, let's go right into the questions we received over the weekend. A lot of them were about what each of us can do in our own lives to reduce our carbon footprint. This is from Karen Chen in response to a segment we did on Friday on eco grief. She says, I have a young child and I feel an overwhelming sense of dread for her future. Are there eco grief resources out there that can guide me through the move from despair and hopelessness to some kind of meaningful response? I've already bought my stainless steel straws and reusable vegetable bags, but I still feel helpless and ineffectual, and sometimes it's hard to go to sleep at night.
I think that what Karen's expressing is the only healthy response to the fact that we haven't made as much progress as we need to make. Now, there are some resources with respect to processing this grief. Marianne Heglar at the National Natural Resources Defense Council has a blog where she writes about climate grief, just this very issue, and I'd encourage people to read it. But I'd say that perhaps the most important thing to do is to not just translate your values into individual action, but to also find community and work with others to take collective action. That's because many of the underlying issues, as Greta and other youth activists have pointed out, are structural and they require a major upheaval. The way to, in fact, achieve this is through just what our youth have done, which is politically organizing and demanding changes through regulation, through incentives, through a major shift in the behavior of companies so that they're more socially minded, like they are, for example, in Scandinavian countries. We need to realize that our individual actions collectively can make a difference, but it's important to really think about what those actions are. So showing up to vote, calling for regulatory changes, calling for particular standards in different industries, it's what's important.
So what you said kind of answers the question that Aida asks. She's another listener. She says, what are some of the small steps we can take to help with climate change? And she says, I ask for the older generation who can maybe start doing their part, like my mother. And you're saying, yeah, it's fine to buy stainless steel straws and all that, but what we really need to do is something bigger and more collective.
I think that's exactly right. We need to be calling for changes in industry and in our economy that support a clean and just green transition. And I really want to emphasize the scale of the action that's needed. So this can be done by, you know, a number of things, demanding more investment in public transit sooner. It can be demanding vegetarian options becoming the norm, right, at your local restaurants and from your local grocery stores, because in fact, meat has a very large carbon cost associated with it. If your passion is fashion, demanding the fashion industry focus on upcycling, and demanding in your community more allotments and community gardens, and actually trees getting planted. There are a whole series of solutions that we can look to do. And if we do these things individually, the scale of the changes and their impacts is small. But if we demand our governments actually and businesses make changes, then there's the chance for these things to scale up and really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so Howard Cohen asks, are there any fiscal incentives available to make a real effort combating climate change that have not been enacted by local, state, or federal governments?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's so much more that can be done with respect to fiscal incentives. I feel like we've only barely scratched the surface. Investment on the scale of a Marshall Plan to support businesses, employees at those businesses, redefining themselves to focus on the just and green transition is really what's necessary. I think there are opportunities to subsidize the local level and the statewide level. People making the transition, for example, to green cars, for example, or introducing solar in a way that is just not economically within reach for many people right now. So there's much more that could be done.
Finally, let's hear from Mark. He called in from New York, and he really has a, well, what if all of this isn't good enough question?
Well, my question was, you know, if we do come to a point where they find out it is too late to reverse climate change, should we start to prepare for the worst, prepare for ice age or some other sort of, you know, catastrophe?
And how do you respond to that?
That's a wonderful question. I want to emphasize that the costs and impacts of 1.5 degrees C of warming, or 2 degrees of warming, or 3 degrees of global warming, or 5 degrees of global warming, each of those scenarios differs from each other, and they have very different implications for what we'd experience here in California or in any region. What that means is that there's no point where it's, in some sense, too late, because if we're able to avoid a 5 degrees C threshold for global warming, that's critically important in some sense. I think another thing to keep in mind is that I think we have crossed the threshold for some changes that are going to occur that are irreversible, but there's the climate system has so many processes in it that, you know, are going to be disturbed basically as we cross different amounts of warming. So it's critical right now to make the changes that we know are going to make a difference. So going 100% renewables by 2030, planting trees, focusing on conserving nature, and scaling up actually things that we know are going to draw down carbon. We have no other choice, really. And, you know, frankly, as a person who studies climate history, you know, thinking about these kind of questions about whether we could have a shutdown of ocean circulation and an ice age, those are things that are so far in our future. What we really need to do is focus on the fact we're having warming that's causing extreme weather, fires and floods, and that we can do something about that by focusing on carbon drawdown right now.
Aradhana Tripathi is a UCLA professor at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Aradhana, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And joining me now is Steve Chiategas, host of Greater LA. What's coming up on your show?
Well, we're going to pick up on the climate change. Obviously, the issue is big. It's before us right now, happening right now. Many things happening right now, such as sea level rise and warmer temperatures, too. We're already seeing it in LA. And we're going to talk more about what LA will see. Maybe a very different LA in the decades to come. So that's coming up in just
important
a few minutes.
Conversation coming up at 1 o'clock. Greater LA with Steve Chiategas. Thank you.
You bet.
And we have a very important conversation happening right now, kcrw.com/join, and that is between you and KCRW, and you becoming a member or renewing your membership. It's vitally important that you do that. This is the final day or two of the UnDrive. We end it tomorrow, and so put it off no longer. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, KCRW's newest DJ, Novena Carmel, daughter of funk royalty Sly Stone, on what you should be listening to right now. She's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Monday, so that means we're talking music, this time with KCRW's newest DJ, Novena Carmel. She's the daughter of funk legend Sly Stone. Bay Area born, but now she is on our airwaves every Sunday from midnight to 3 a.m. I guess that's Monday, technically.
Yeah.
She joins me now. Hi there, Novena.
Hi.
With some of her favorite songs. Welcome, and welcome to KCRW.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here and for you to share some music with us.
Yes.
So what kind of music do you play on your show?
Oh, man. I mean, it's really eclectic. You know, KCRW is eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like music that has soul to it, but that doesn't necessarily mean soul music. It's just stuff that I feel like the soul is oozing out of it. I also like to just have fun and play stuff that's upbeat and gets people moving. I like to have my own dance party in the studio.
Are you by yourself when you're doing that?
Yeah, me and maybe like an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
But that helps. You know, I'm on late, so it's like keeps the energy going.
Yeah, it's good. And plus, you know, everyone who's listening.
Yeah, exactly.
They're in there with you.
Yes.
Okay, so let's play one song
to
get us going.
All right.
That you have brought. This is called Hi Babe by the Ngozi family.
Okay.
When I wake up, I go to Matero. I meet some girls. I got to say, hi, baby.
fantastic. So where is the Ngozi family from?
From Zambia.
Wow.
And yeah, this is an old song. I know it's hard to tell these days because people make like that vintage sounding music. And they do a style of music called Zamrock. So it's like
Zamrock?
Zambia rock.
Got it.
Yeah. And this song, I kind of like to picture it like I wake up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror and say, hi, baby. Like jump out of bed to that beat, you know? That's just what it makes me feel.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Hi, Babe by the Ngozi family. All right. So you like African music because you brought another track from South Sudan.
Yeah, so this is a brother-sister collab, Emmanuel Jal and Nyarurach.
Nyarwatch singing.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Wow. So it's really interesting as a DJ because, you know, I just hear songs and I like the way it sounds, right? And then I'm like, okay, I want to know more about this artist. And in that search, I found out that this song is actually a brother and sister. So Emmanuel is the brother. Nyarwatch is the sister. And they're originally from South Sudan, and there was a civil war there that separated them when they were children. And their story is heartbreaking and way too common, where the brother was forced to join a rebel army, and the sister, I mean, she went, it's almost hard to say, but she was severely abused, we'll say, through her experiences, and then fled with family to, I believe it was Kenya, where she was finally reunited, I want to say decades later, with her brother. And now they're making music together.
Oh my gosh.
And I mean, you hear the song and it sounds like a happy song.
Yeah.
Which I mean, being reunited is happy, but just the story is crazy too. So.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yes.
And so now they're making music together.
Yes.
They're touring around.
Mm-hmm.
And are they talking about their experiences?
For Nyarwatch, it was really difficult for her to talk about it for a long time. But then there was a documentary that was made where she finally felt open to start talking about her experiences. And I mean, considering what's happening in Sudan today, it's really relevant as well, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it helped her heal and help others heal as well.
You were born and bred in the Bay.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
How do you compare the two music scenes?
Wow, the two music scenes. A lot of the music that's close to my heart is the Bay Area music that I listened to when I was growing up in the 90s. And so when people ask me, like, who's my favorite rapper, for example, I would say E-40, which may be a funny answer. And I don't even really listen to a lot of E-40 these days. But I just think of a kid and how E-40 was like our hero in the Bay Area. And he was like one of the first guys to wear glasses proudly, but still have credibility. As a rapper. And he's just so creative in his style. So I, I'll always love E-40.
Okay, good. The good answer. Well, can you talk a little bit about your dad and his influence on you?
Yeah. So my dad, I mean, that's classic Bay Area sound as well, like the rock and funk coming out of the kind of hippie scene of the Bay Area. I mean, like I said earlier, I love music that has soul, and who has soul like Sly Stone, Sly and the Family Stone, you know?
And great outfits. Can we just say that
too? Great outfits. Let's not forget.
Wow.
Yeah. And I might add, he started out as a radio DJ, which is pretty interesting as a full circle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Scenario. Yeah.
So you really are following in his footsteps.
I am.
In
yeah. In my own way. Yeah. In many ways and in my own way. And I mean, I come from a musical family. My mom was a dancer and super into music. My uncle was a pretty well-known Brazilian composer, singer, guitarist, Oscar Castro Neves. He was one of the pioneers of bossa nova music, bringing it to the U.S. He toured with Sergio Mendes. So, yeah, surrounded by music since birth. Gilberto Gil was at my first birthday, which was in Rio.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to the music.
All right.
You picked more music for us to hear. And we're going to hear something from an Australian group this time. It's called the Teskey Brothers. Here is So Caught Up. I'm not feeling on my mind. Feeling on the edge. There's only one thing I can be certain. It's true. I'm so caught on you. Because I That is really soulful.
Right? Yeah.
From Australia.
Yeah.
From Melbourne.
It was funny. I was watching, there's the collaborative called Colors Studios. They do these really cool recordings of artists. And they did one with the Teskey brothers. Well, it was just one of the brothers. And the comments were like, I didn't know Thor sounded like that because he looks kind of similar to like Thor.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show, you know, soul music comes out of anywhere and it feels really authentic, which I like. It doesn't feel like he's trying to be, I mean, he sounds like a lot like Otis Redding or something,
yeah.
But it feels like it's when you watch him play, it feels authentic.
Continuing our worldwide tour, let's go to Sweden now and listen to a band called Off the Meds.
If I ever connect to you, I'm connected to you. If I'm your friend, I'm your friend. I mean, you my brother, you through thick and thin. Come hell and high water, no canoe, no rowboat and no swimming trunks. I'm still in the water with you, trying to get you out with a great shaking. But you must understand that every shaking is not bad. Many shakings are good. Many times we receive a direction through persecution. If I don't say anything else, I preach right there. Yeah. I'm your friend. I mean, you my brother, friend.
Hey,
it's a party. You know. I was wondering where he's going with that.
I know, right? Yeah. But, you know, you got to wait for the beat to drop. That's like classic house music.
That's perfect. So tell me about this band.
Yeah, so I don't know a lot about them, but they are from Sweden, and I think the front man is originally from South Africa, so there's at least one of their songs that has a South African dialect being spoken in the song, which is a cool mashup with house music. And this one, I think it's a sample of like Bishop T.D. Jakes or somebody that's like a pastor, like a Christian pastor,
okay.
Pastor or something. I don't know, but I just thought it was such an interesting sample to then turn into like a house music. And I like what he's saying, too. Like, if I'm your friend, then I'm your friend through hella high water. You know. So, yeah, it's a fun one to play. I always like to have songs that are good for the dance floor because I love DJing parties as well. So it's a good one.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
OK, let's go out with one of the originals, Stevie Wonder.
Ooh.
Why did you choose this song? This is called Love's in Need of Love Today.
I was just thinking about, okay, I want to pick a song that is timeless and that came out a while ago and it still super resonates. And so the first song that popped into my head was this song. And then I sat and I started listening to it. And when I listened to the lyrics and the way Stevie sings it, I almost started crying because it was just so relevant. And obviously Stevie's voice is beautiful. So
if love and peace you treasure, then you'll hear me when I say, oh, oh, that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in right away.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah, and
love's
and
in need of love today.
Yes. And right after that, the lyrics go, hate's going around breaking many hearts. Stop it, please, before we go too far. There's so many things that I see in the news, whether it be with the climate change and the planet and how the glaciers are melting and things having to do with human beings. And I always think, like, how far is going to be too far? They'll say, we have 4 more years to fix this crisis, you know? And I'm like, stop. Can we just stop this? So, yeah.
Well, that's kind of a sad note to end on, but you're such an uplifting person and such a happy person that we know that your show isn't sad.
Well, I feel like sometimes you need to hear the bitter truth, but there's always optimism possible. And I think Stevie's voice brings a lot of optimism as well. So
definitely.
It's okay to feel sad and then think about what we need to do to get out of the mess that we're in. So
excellent. Okay. And then you can get more information on Monday mornings. From 12 to 3.
Yeah, Sunday night / Monday morning, midnight to 3.
Listening to Navina Carmel, KCRW's newest DJ. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
It was awesome.
Yay. If I ever connect to you, I'm connected to you. If I'm your friend, I'm your friend. I mean, you my brother. You through thick and thin. Come hell and high water, no canoe, no rowboat and no swimming trunks. I'm still in the water with you, trying to get you out. I'm your friend, I'm your friend. I mean, you my brother's friend. I'm your friend. I'm your friend. I mean, you my brother's friend. I'm your friend. I'm your friend.
All right. The band Off the Meds singing the song Friend. Hey, guess what? KCRW is your friend. And you know what? You're our friend, too. So be a good friend and join. KCRW.com/join or 800-600-5279. Whatever it takes. Just get there. Come on. Do it for us. Do it for your old pal, KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.